Okay, welcome back. As promised, Clifford Carnicom is back with us tonight. For a couple of hours, we're going to spend trying to cover some of his remarkable research. He has turned his, his far-reaching intellect, his scientific curiosity, and a drive for knowledge and wisdom toward the issue of Morgellons. What is it? What's behind it? What's causing it? And what can be done about it? There's a lot on the line here. Clifford, of course, is world-renowned for his extraordinary research and accomplishments in trying to resolve the issue of chemtrails. The two appear to be related somehow. Welcome back, Clifford. How are you?
Good evening, Jeff. I'm very well, and thanks very much for the chance to be here again with you.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Always my, I don't know how many years you've been on the program now, but it's, well,
we're getting close to a decade now on this stuff.
I'd say. Clifford has a website, carnicom.com, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, real simple, carnicom.com. His material is there. It's a prodigious amount of information he has collected and determined through his own research, and I call him America's greatest citizen scientist, because he's not working on a grant, he's not working for a major corporation, he's not under the control of anybody. He is working to help all of us. And as you well know, those of you who have been following the program and been with us for any length of time at all, the fraud, the farce, the outrageous, disgusting, vile insult of the CDC allegedly tossing $200,000 or thereabout, $300,000, what is it? I don't know, to Kaiser Permanente to study Morgellons. How many phone calls have you gotten from the CDC, Clifford, about your research?
Well, you know, I haven't received any. I actually put up a statement to that effect that, there's some information here, and they haven't called me yet, and neither has the EPA called
me. Nor will they, and I well remember your EPA issues and calling them, calling their bluff, basically, and they owned up to their duplicity and their treasonous behavior in that letter. I'll never forget that.
And tonight there's going to be, as we talk tonight, I think there's going to be a couple loops that tie into these things. There's some links being made that are going back literally 9 years, and causing us to revisit some of that original research that took place, and the EPA is a part of that story, and they're not off the hook yet, as far as I'm concerned.
Very good. All right, let's proceed then. And for all of you who are interested, and I know that's all of you because you care, or you wouldn't be listening to this program. Sit back and open your mind and prepare to hear some extraordinary material. Go right ahead, Clifford. I'm here.
Jeff, thank you very much. I did send you an email a few minutes ago. I'm not sure if you got it, but I had an outline before, and I'm going to try to stick to that outline. And I have a couple revisions that have been made to that. And I thought the first thing that would be helpful is just to spend a little bit of time reviewing what we talked about last meeting in a brief form, just to sort of summarize what we've been through and get us caught up to where we're going, and I'll try to work my way through the rest of the papers.
Yeah, I have the email. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Great. And there are a couple of announcements that I've been requested to make, so if we have time during the show at some point, I'll do that if you find it appropriate.
All right.
But in terms of reviewing what we talked about last time, the chronology in this, and it's not just the Morgellons issue, but what's happening is we're finding links. We're finding common ground between what has been called the Morgellons issue and the aerosol issue. And this is why it's important to join these subjects together now in our discussion. And the Morgellons issue from my side came up in a more serious way in August of 2006, and I had a paper called First Observations, and we talked about this last time, and this was the first time that a sample under controlled conditions was provided to me by an individual, and that sample was put under the microscope, where we finally had a good look, really the first look that I could find. You know, you had this site supposedly researching this issue for several years prior to this, 3 years at least, and I had just waited, assumed they were basically doing their work. And when Jan Smith contacted me At that point, I'm asking, well, you know, where are the photos? What is it that we're looking at? And I go onto the sites, and I find nothing. I find no images of what it is we're even talking about, a suitable magnification. So that's where it started, was to get this material under the scope and get at least a reasonable image out of it. And at that time, that work was up to probably about 3,000 to 5,000 powers, it was up to 5,000. So there was somewhat of a breakthrough that had taken place at that time with the microscope, which is not that complicated, actually. And, in fact, there's one person requesting me to make that information available, and I'm going to do that to him, and he may be the person that publicizes it. But it does use conventional CCD technology. I see actually no reason why with just a little bit more resources we shouldn't be able to pull together a scope that can, you know, make a significant improvement even over what I've done. You know, I'm up to 5,000 or 6,000. But I'm using, you know, very conventional CCD technology. Yes, I've modified things a little bit, but I see no reason why with good quality CCD technology. I mean, there's a lot of astronomy work that's done now. You have some very high resolution cameras that are available. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that I can't see why we wouldn't be able to get up to 20,000 power or so with some good high-resolution digital cameras and good optics and that type of thing.
A quick note, most of the images on the Internet now are in the neighborhood of 60 to 100 power, correct?
Exactly true, and this is my problem. You know, we can't really begin a discussion at something happening at the microbiological level unless we can see what it is we're talking about. And so there's been a real strong drive on my part to get the best information I can, at least, to see what it is we're talking about. So right. Jan provided that, and we had some images, which to me were rather groundbreaking. And we talked about that last time. They show some definite structures and forms showing up. At that point, I'm just presenting it. I'm not trying to really draw any conclusions, just describe physically what I'm seeing. But there's some very definite forms that show up at this high magnification that are extremely interesting. Very briefly, you have that you have the main fiber, which is encapsulating an interior network of fibers at the submicron level. You have a spherical structure, and as we go along, they increase in attention and interest on my side. Some people seem to have an interest in dismissing them. On my side, my interest increases the more I go along with this and the more that I see these and the less that they are basically attended to and identified. But you have three out of the four forms that are showing up in this very early work. And so we talked about how you had a break. You had a gap of roughly, I think it's till November, if I remember right, of 2007.
Yeah.
Before the next opportunity comes around for me to look at another sample. And what was different here was that I had direct access to the individual that manifested these rather serious skin conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had direct access to samples, really several now instead of just one or two fibers. And those were put under the scope. And what we learned at this time is that you have an exact match to the T, exact match to the previous work of roughly close to a year and a half ago. The problem being that you have a year and a half of elapsed time with no progress at all, from what I can see, and a presentation of, yes, it's the same information, but I don't mean to say same in terms of, dullness and repetition, same old hat. I mean that you have a year and a half elapsed with the presentation of significant microbiological information that is at the base of ailments that are increasing in distribution and frequency, and you have a year and a half lapse, and then you learn the same level of knowledge comes to you a year and a half later.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no progress. And that is when I started to get, say, a little bit riled up on this issue, that I was completely dissatisfied with the lack of progress on this issue. And, you know, you mentioned and made reference to the CDC, you know, and what are they doing, you know, during this year and a half?
Well,
they're playing all kinds of games.
Of course, obfuscating. But the issue that Clifford is discussing has to do really with some key players in the so-called Morgellons community who literally produced next to nothing for a long period of time, a group of them, and I'm not naming any names or pointing fingers at anyone in particular here, but the community itself had some able people involved, and there was just nothing forthcoming of any great significance. There was the baseline, and then there was pretty much not much beyond that. Is that a fair summation?
This is correct. You didn't even have images. You didn't even have images.
That's right. That's right. So, thank goodness for Clifford Carnicom. His brilliance is now focused firmly on this outrageous syndrome. It is not a virus. It's not a bacteria in any classic sense, which has appeared on 7 continents now and may well be afflicting or infecting or infesting millions, perhaps tens of millions of people, perhaps the environment, perhaps many so-called lower life forms on the planet, perhaps plants, perhaps trees. We don't know, but we're going to find out. Okay, right back to our conversation with Clifford Carnicom, the conversation of discovery and science about Morgellons. All right, Clifford.
Jeff, thanks a lot. Two more articles to summarize, and then we'll be caught up to date. The next pursuit involved the blood, and this was somewhat accidental. I should probably start amending my work, because in a sense it's not really four forms. It's really five forms that have been identified repeatedly. You know, the four that I mentioned last time, you have this enclosing or encapsulating fiber. You have this sub-micron internal network of fibers. Then you have this oblate or spherical structure, which we talked about a little bit. My best candidate right now is that of chlamydia pneumonia. Oh, and remember, the usual caveat here for all of us, you know, and that is I'm not a doctor. I'm not offering any medical advice whatsoever, no diagnosis, no assessment. I am providing the results of extended observation as an independent researcher, and I will do that.
Very good.
But I'm not offering any medical advice whatsoever on this. So we have that third form, which is an oblate or spherical structure, also to submicron level. Best candidate that I can offer is that of chlamydia pneumonia. I noticed you had put up an article on some research you did on that a few days ago, and we'll go over, if we have time later, why I consider that as a candidate. That is a rather unusual, exotic bacterial form. It is not in the conventional classification schemes. I think it wasn't even actually discovered until 1965, if I remember right.
We'll talk
more about that. And the fourth would be what I call this hybrid form, or it's sort of a ribbon form. Not really in either category. A ribbon is the best, like sausage shape. That's about the best I can offer right now. Mycoplasma is one consideration. But the fifth form, which really did show up at the very beginning, which should be included as a part of this because it ends up also being important in where we're trying to go in learning what is the nature of what we're talking about, and that is that budding structure. On the original samples, the fiber samples that Jan sent me, mm-hmm. you had this appearance of what appears to be a growth structure. I just can't see right now any other likely explanation for its purpose.
Right.
It's a concentrated bud. Like you imagine a bud growing out on a tree or something, where the whole fiber network, as well as that submicron, I'll refer to it as chlamydia-like, just to keep things simple,
sure.
rather than keep saying oblate or spherical structure. Chlamydia-like would be what I'll use as a term. But you have this bud on the side of the fiber, or on the exterior, you know, the boundary of it, that is encapsulating both the continued presence of the fibers, submicron fibers, and that chlamydia-like form. And that ends up being important when we start talking about the possibility of fungal forms later this evening. And so there would be five forms. And so one of these that's serving as a cross-link to this next paper on blood was that chlamydia-like structure. Remember, in the original fiber that sent, I'm seeing this chlamydia-like structure. Well, I start looking at my blood. We can say accidentally, for whatever reason, I was looking at my blood. And we also talked about the use of the laser light last time and how that revealed the presence of these structures that in no way could they be seen in that quantity or to that ease under regular visible light, but the laser light really brought this stuff out and ended up being very helpful to detect these anomalies. So there's a crossover. I started looking at my blood, we could say out of curiosity or whatever, but I start seeing these same chlamydia-like structures. Again, we don't have positive identification, but in terms of what I'm able to accomplish, and that is basically size, shape, structure, and form. That's what I can accomplish at my side by observation. We have an exact match occurring within the blood now of an individual. And how does it start out? First of all, it starts out with my blood that I see these anomalies. Don't really know how much attention to pay to that because I don't have any frame of reference. So at that point, the second individual that manifested the rather serious skin conditions provided their blood sample. And that was a little bit of a shocker, I guess, at that point, because you see everything I'm talking about except a whole lot more and a lot more accentuated. I mean, those photographs are up there. We talked about them a little bit last time. Mm-hmm. But they show, I don't know how you could say otherwise, they showed serious disruptions to the blood, the cellular integrity, the aggregation, you know, the cellular form in general. And then you find these internal structures starting to show up in that blood that, again, for right now, I have to offer that candidate of chlamydia pneumonia as a candidate. You also have the presence of that ribbon-like structure. And there was one photograph that we did call attention to, and it was the first one. You sort of brought up the issue of, you know, when did we get into that critical level of seeing the blood at sufficient magnification where we were seeing these. And there is one photograph on that paper that was called blood testing, lasers, Morgellons, and fungus, mm-hmm. where for the first time we could start to see that ribbon-like structure within the blood as well as see those chlamydia-like structures. And you're starting to see your first hint or evidence that these things look like they're actually inside of the blood cells, inside the erythrocytes. It wasn't known to what degree at that point, but that opened up the door for further blood examination as we talk further.
Very good. All right, we'll do that with Clifford in just a couple minutes. Do go to his website. All this material is there. Look at my website. There is just an enormous amount of material about Morgellons at Rentz.com. Many, many, many photographs from the heroic Jan Smith. Contributions, of course, by Cliff Mickelson and others. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. Okay, let's get right to it with Clifford Conacom. All right, Clifford, we're right there up to date. Let's step off into the next level.
Jeff, thanks a lot. The last paper we talked about represents, to me, a significant consolidation of effort. And this paper is called Morgellons Airborne Skin and Blood, A Match. And I see this is on December 10th, so we're getting near the end of last year. It's actually sort of a flurry, if we notice here, of a lot of research that's done within a couple months. I'm going to go ahead and mention so that people know that, you know, the truth is I'm stretched out to the point now in my life. I'm lucky if I get a couple hours a week of solid work on this subject now. My time is extremely limited. So this is not the kind of thing that I can offer on any kind of perpetual basis. And what happened during those months of November and December of last year, we had just had quite a flurry of time that I spent to get to a certain point.
Oh, if we could only turn you loose on this full time. Wow.
We obviously need the resources. I mean, there's so many questions that have been brought up just in this short amount of work that's been done. But we did have these benefits, and so at least we have a base to start working with, but it is just that, just a base. But at the close of last year, we have this paper that I wrote, and it's disturbing in its implications. A couple things come out of this paper that are very significant. The first is that there is now, for the first time, a link that is established on a physical basis, I mean by direct physical observation. Again, what am I able to get under the scope? Size, shape, form, and structure. That's what I'm able to get under the scope. So we have a link now that takes place in December between that original airborne sample, that environmental airborne fiber sample that was sent to the EPA way back in 1999. I revisit that sample because the microscopy has been improved on my side to where I'm able to get into more detail than I ever was able to. You know, when I started that stuff, if you look back, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of that early work tonight, but I was working with a $30 toy telescope with a single lens reflex camera strapped onto the top of the eyepiece to get those first images we had of those fibers. Just simply did not have at all the kind of information that we've been able to pull out over the last 6 months or so, or 6 months to a year. So I revisited that environmental sample from the EPA, and what do we have? We can see for the first time that we have three of these five forms that I'm talking about duplicate themselves within that airborne environmental sample. Namely, you have this encapsulating fiber, that which can be seen just barely with a human eye. Even that sample, when people look at it, what they thought was, you know, a single fiber was literally in the thousands and thousands of fibers. It was known that there was a submicron component at that point. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't know until this work in December was within a single fiber that I could isolate, I was able to segregate or identify that you could finally see for the first time there was indeed an entire sub-network within that encapsulating fiber, exactly identical in form to what came out of the skin samples of these two individuals that manifest Morgellons conditions. So that, of course, is very significant in that it establishes for the very first time, there may have been suspicions that there's certainly similarities. That was alluded to probably 5 years ago by my work, that there were certainly some similarities in the filament nature of what we're dealing with. But at this level of observation, for the first time, we see really a, how do you call it, you know? What do you, I'm always so diplomatic, a sufficient basis for investigation, right?
Yes.
This is what I keep saying. But, you know, what I'm saying is to the best degree possible, you have an exact match as far as I can get down to 5,000-7,000 power.
Yeah.
Of the environmental sample that the EPA refuses to identify, refuses to acknowledge.
Won't even acknowledge it. No.
Let alone. And so this, again, this stuff is all coming around. You know, eventually it loops around. I believe the truth is known over time. No matter how long it takes, the truth will be known.
Well, somebody knows it. It's just not us yet. But, yeah.
And that is a significant threshold to be crossing in terms of many of our questions that we're asking as to, you know, what is the means and methods by which the population is being injured. And now we have a basis, certainly, for investigation, again, the very mild way of saying it, between those original environmental filament samples that the EPA refuses to identify and the manifestation of serious physical conditions in the population.
Right.
So that's the first thing that comes out of that article. The other that is significant, and both of these I regard as extremely important points at this stage of the research. And the second is that what you have is similar, let's say, degradation of cellular form, blood form, blood cells, erythrocytes, similar physical forms of these five types I'm talking about. You now start to see the same forms and same degradation occurring not within just the individual that manifests these skin conditions where we segregate these people off and say, oh, that person has Morgellons, not me, that person, I can see something on their skin, so they have something.
Mm-hmm.
But no, not me. But what do you find under the scope? You start seeing that people that show no visible symptoms of any kind, nothing irregular on the exterior of their body, internally are showing the same types of degradation and anomalies and physical forms that I have described within both types of individuals. This opens up a bigger Pandora's box for us. Because now we see that we may be under, let's say, an illusion that we can separate off a certain small segment of the population and treat them as being, oh, something separate. Yes, it's interesting, very unique, but, boy, I'm glad I don't have it. And what I'm saying is we're not dealing, it doesn't matter whether you can see it or not. It looks like we have something that's crossing the line over. And that was done with a small sample at that point, but it opened the door to saying, hey, where this can't be restricted to people that are manifesting some certain skin condition. And that was a summary of what we reached, I think, last time we talked. And from this point on, I'll go on and carry through with the additional work if you'd like.
Sure, please.
So the next thing that happens, you know, I tend to sort of follow the chronology because that's how the research unfolds, is one step leads to another step. The next step is, and I see this is occurring in January, 2 or 3 weeks later, the individual that I had access to, I mean, I'm going to go ahead and mention her name because she's publicly announced. Her name's Dr. Gwen Scott. She's a naturopathic doctor. And as people go along here, they will learn that she deserves a great deal of credit. This individual has offered a great deal over many years. This person has contributed in their way every much as I have towards the public's understanding of this issue. This person provided some more information to us that ends up being extremely important involving a dental sample.
Very good.
And it sounds like you have a break, so I'll carry on after that.
All right. Keep that name in mind, and we'll continue with Clifford and bring you information about the dental sample. This is all, again, being heard for the first time right here, and we are very much indebted to Clifford. Back after this. Morgellons, a nightmare for all of those who have it, and a nightmare in waiting for those who have it and don't know it. And those numbers could be in the tens. We don't know. They could be hundreds of millions. We just don't know. This is clearly an issue that has the potential to permeate the entire environment on this biosphere in which we live. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thanks, Jeff. And you know what I'm talking about here. I'll be stressed again that this is not any kind of therapy at all. It has nothing to do with therapy, but it does have to do with a test, with a physical act.
I understand.
That can be performed.
Sure.
That raises many, many questions. But what happened here? I gave at least opening credit to Dr. Gwen Scott, but people really have no idea how unselfish she has been and what she has offered to the public over the years. She's not really an internet, that's not her bailiwick, so she's more on just on the personal side. But she's offered a great deal of help to people in ways that many of us don't even appreciate yet. But in January, beginning of January, Gwen calls me and tells me that there's something very unusual taking place. And so I go down there to document it. And, you know, what was occurring was that Gwen had a very severe toothache, extremely painful. And when she's saying painful, she's meaning painful. It was extreme and very protracted, and there was nothing that she was doing that was giving any relief or pain.
Really?
Gwen gets her information in various ways, as I do too, but let's just say she has a very strong sense of intuition. And there was something quite unusual that occurred. It's just a fact, but it ends up being very important to us. And that is she sought out in her ways what could she possibly do to relieve this toothache. And she receives information in, let's say, normally considered a non-rational or non-logical means, to rinse her mouth out with red wine. She does this. And it was quite a surprise. She had no idea where this was going or necessarily why this was being given to her as something to try, but she did this. And all we can say, it's quite incredible what has happened and what we have learned and through whatever means. We can consider this somewhat of a blessing in terms of at least having this information available.
Right. Better to know than not to know, yeah.
Yeah, with the understanding that nobody's talking about this as any therapy. But what happens is this red wine, when sloshed around in her teeth for quite a while, produces a fibrous network expelling from the wine sample. In other words, if you're not talking about drinking, you're talking about rinsing around vigorously in your mouth. And a deep, dark red wine is what we're talking about here. Rinsing around the mouth for a minute or two very, very vigorously. And when it was expelled into the sink, a massive amount, the pictures are there, but a massive amount of a fibrous material, filament network, was expelled from the sample. And We don't know why, necessarily. Obviously, there's something going on. It looks like the grape ends up being important here. But the photographs are on the site, and people can see this. This is under the paper that's called Mergellon's A Fourth Match. And this paper was somewhat understated in terms of its significance. But this makes no sense when you look at it. It's rather shocking for people to behold. There are plenty of people that really seem very reluctant or hesitant, at the least, to even consider. I call it a test. It's not a theory. This is a test. And if you do it, it's going to start raising some questions for a lot of people. But the photographs are taken there, and they're taken with fairly low magnification, and it's very unusual. You're looking, no reason you would ever expect that to be coming from the teeth. And by the way, the mouth is cleaned as much as possible before this is done. There's nothing about something being in the mouth and something like that.
Sure.
So this is followed through, and what am I able to do? I'm able to get this under the scope and look at it. And what do we see? We see that this material that's being expelled from the teeth in rather large quantities through a fairly simple means, certainly more accessible than blood sampling and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
We see the same identical structure as we have now spent, the hour and a half describing on the recent research. You see the same exact forms again. You see the encapsulating filament. You see the submicron internal network. And you see the chlamydia-like structures, and there are several photographs, and those are up to 7,000 power.
What was your personal response to this?
We're dealing with something that is so deeply based. We're talking now about the entire body being at risk here.
Right.
Not something that we can just, associate with the skin.
Well, we're talking about different forms within
the body.
We tried to make that clear last time. Mergellon's is not a skin disease or disorder.
Absolutely correct from what I see. It appears to be literally a system-wide condition. But now we had a quite simple means of producing a physical sample that any of us can put under examination and start asking some very serious questions of what this is. I haven't really talked to an individual yet that has performed this test that isn't rather taken aback and somewhat shocked.
How many people who perform the test are showing the same results?
It's up to about 30 to 35 more formally, where they've told me that it's been done. It takes me about 2 hours under the scope for each person, so I've only put a quarter of those people under the scope.
Mm-hmm.
But every single one, up to the microscope level, 7,000, it's always a match. Roughly 35,000 formerly, there's an informal network. Now I'm losing track is what it amounts to. But what's happening thus far, Jeff, and it's not to try and exaggerate it or overstate it, but the fact is that every single individual that has done this test produces something physical. And the only thing of the same exact form, and the only thing that is varying is the amount or the quantity that's being expelled. This has now been done. There is a couple individuals. I'll say I'm in the game, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the bag. So far, I can't say anyone that I know that's not. But I've been doing this for well over 2 months now, quite frequently. We could say literally on essentially a daily basis. There is no stop at this point.
So what you're saying, Clifford, is that to one degree or another, everyone who does this little test is showing some of the unmistakable materials that your research has identified.
Thus far, that is the case. And again, I'm not trying to exaggerate anything, but thus far, that is the case. And just, if you take a statistical look at that, you're way outside of the norms once you actually got past a few people. Let's take this, this Mergellon's conference as well as what the CDC did. They're poking around numbers like 1 in 15,000. They're saying 15,000 people in the world may be suspect to having this condition, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is an absolute joke in terms of what the evidence is showing. If you had 1 in 15,000 and you thought that this was random, your chances of finding 35 people in consecutive order across many state lines of this country, we're working on international samples next, because there isn't a we on this one, But for you to start coming up with any numbers past just a few people at that point, statistically, you went way outside the norms you know, you're talking about one in, I think I had it up to 26 zeros, okay? The chances of this happening by chance are just absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Well, so the notion of, you know, 15,000 people, which the CDC is trying to proffer as well as came out of that Mergellan's conference, seems to be absolutely ludicrous, at least based on the evidence that I'm seeing. This is profound in terms of its impact on people. It does appear as though many people would rather not basically confront
it.
The issue. All I can say is it's indicative of a systemic situation that involves the entire body and indeed a certain preference, it looks like, maybe for the gum and teeth area. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along tonight also.
All right, fascinating. The international samples. Well, we'll hear from you when you're ready.
Right. I don't have that information yet, but there are some people helping out to work on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is an amazing discovery, and I don't know what to do because I can't hide from what I see. I just call it as I see it. I'm not out to scare people. I never have been out to scare people. But if I see something, I have to call it as I see it.
Well, it's called science, Clifford, and
you know,
no need to apologize for it or explain it. You've always been that way. You tell it like it is.
And we have to deal with this situation, okay?
Right.
And that is that the physical forms are manifesting within every individual that's been analyzed. And actually, you know, there's been two people, one person in particular said, well, there's nothing there. I don't see anything at all. You know, and we talked about it for a little while, and they had me convinced I didn't see anything. And that's fine. In fact, I'd like to find that as soon as possible. But when I looked at it, indeed it was there. And the truth is, actually, even if it's not going to be visible to the eye, it's going to have to be put under the scope to make any kind of final determination of whether it's there or not because of the size level that we're talking about here at the submicron level. So
just about a minute until the top of the hour.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. So this is now a turning point in terms of, let's say, knowledge of the potential extent and distribution of the problem and situation.
Which, to this point in time, suggests, in terms of your research, 100%.
At this point, yes. Again, I actually am hoping to see the exception. I just don't have it yet at this point. And either way, again, we're way outside those statistical norms. So the next paper, and maybe we don't finish this, but the next thing that happens is that a parent offers her child for a blood sample observation. Also very generous and kind of this individual to do this. I know it's sort of a heavy subject to get into, but the question of whether or not children might be affected came up. And that's what we can talk about when we return.
Very good. We shall do so with Clifford Carnicom in just a few minutes. Again, all of these articles he is alluding to can be seen on his homepage. Just simply look for the title of them. And don't forget our intense aggregation of Morgellons material on the left-hand side of Rents.com for you. All right, be right back. Another hour to go. Okay, and welcome back. Our second hour coming up now with Clifford Carnicom talking about Morgellons, the affliction, the disorder, the syndrome, which quite clearly has identifiable components now in 100% of the people that Clifford has worked with. This is an issue that may well be spread around the planet now. We don't know. The government is quite clearly obfuscating the issue as well. All right, Clifford, let's go right ahead.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, we have to put on par with our discussion of Morgellons all of the historical work and research done by the countless people across the world for the last 8 to 9, 10 years on aerosol or chemtrail issue because of the connections that we're seeing. We must now consider that as a composite investigation. Before I discuss this paper on the observation of the sample from a child, I want to take a slight little detour, if I can, and it's simply to sure to show the historical context of how sort of research unfolds and the links that are made, sometimes not knowing until years later,
mm-hmm.
How certain connections will take place. But if we look back at my work, there was a paper that I wrote in December of 2003, and that paper was called An Unusual Medical Finding. And that paper involved where I started to develop a tooth problem somewhat unexpectedly and quickly.
Which tooth? What kind of, describe it, like an impacted tooth, an infected tooth, just a sore tooth, what?
Sore tooth. I got a lot of pain up in the up in the gum.
No other
and
symptoms?
That's going to end up being real important in our discussion tonight as we go along. But,
right.
You know, 5 years ago I had a very unusual, let's say, set of circumstances take place. We can talk about that one all night. But it also, it involved a laser light also. It involved demonstration of motility or movement of some type of form unknown at that time. Something that would move around within the mouth, a response to light, and basically appear to seek refuge. And that continues on and gets a little bit more complicated if we had time to talk about it. But at that time, in December of 2003, I did write this paper. And what happened was, in that painful area of the tooth, I extracted a small sample. I put it under the scope with the equipment I had at that time and presented it and said, this is what I see. And what did I see at that time? I saw a fibrous network appearing and had no idea how that might link in at some point. That was, if we actually look at my work closely, you'll see that's the first time that I made a reference that we may have a similarity of form between other filament samples we're looking at environmentally airborne and something that's occurring in the human body. But it was so preliminary at that point, it was strictly a suggestion that maybe something is going on. Now, on my side, I knew that there was a little bit more going on that I didn't write about, and that had to do with the unusual response of this pain to laser light and the motion of it,
yeah.
and what I would call seeking of refuge.
Mm-hmm.
So that paper was put there, and the little detour here is that, you know, I have certain detractors in my research. They don't seem to be quite as popular or successful as they were in the early years. But, you know, there's a certain body of people that have certainly attempted to ridicule or discredit my work, especially in the early years. I'll just say as a point of observation, I keep track of that a little bit because sometimes responses are helpful. And I noticed two main responses over the years, and that is one is if the information is so profound that it truly may impact, let's say, the large-scale population, I see one of two responses commonly that come from the detractor, and that is one of complete avoidance, no reaction whatsoever. In other words, don't say a single word. Just do not react.
Mm-hmm.
And that can, let's say, diminish the publicity of an issue sometimes if there's simply no reaction. The other is one of ridicule, that of attempting to discredit a person. I've never really mentioned this before, but let's just say casually, I keep track of this over the years. And there are three areas where I have noticed this rather concerted effort to ridicule something, which from my standpoint was simply presented as another observation, right? Nothing that I'm doing is, let's say, elevated in its priority. At this point, you're gathering information. So I put up these papers. To me, they're the same as all other papers.
Yes, yes. The origin of the criticism, you've got my interest here. I'm
yeah.
curious.
So there's three areas where there's been sort of, to me, an unusual sort of focus and effort to try and discredit that work, and they are as follows. The first one is this article I wrote on this extraction of this tooth sample in December 2003. You know, if you look at the personal attacks that have been made, you know, and the old internet buzz and all that kind of junk that goes on, there's been a rather inordinate response to that article about, you know, Clifford Carnicum extracting the sample from his tooth and subjecting himself to pain, you know, in somewhat of, let's say, a crazed fashion. Why would such an individual ever do that, okay? So that's one, and it caught my interest at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I could add on a fourth, but that would be the immediate, when people started reporting filament, you know, San Francisco did a television news piece on it. They started to have video footage, and people were talking about the filaments for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
They really went after those people. But the second one in my case would be all that work that I did that encountered erythrocytes or desiccated what appeared to be the best I can come up with, not much doubt in my mind, of desiccated red blood cells or erythrocytes in airborne samples. There was very strong efforts made to ridicule and discredit their work. And the reason I'm saying this at this time, folks, is that in the end, these end up being clues. they're clues to us.
You bet they
are. To some things that should be taken, rather importantly, if you'll get past the little hoopla that goes along out on the Internet buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And just pay attention to them. And the third one, and these are all curious things. I can sit back and laugh at them in a certain way, too, because they would seem ludicrous when you first read of them. I can see why somebody might do that. But there's more to it than that under the scenes, and I know that. And the third one had to do with the use of a hair perm solution. And we're going to talk more about this later, because on the surface, it does become humorous. Why would Clifford Carnicom be using hair perm solution on something? Well, that's going to be a little bit interesting as we go along here. But that work, if you look at it, dates back literally to 1999. It's when that first EPA sample came up.
Mm-hmm.
I did some work involving use of a hair perm, and it's going to get into the subject of protein analysis. That's where it's going to go, and we'll get there hopefully later tonight. Because there's some interesting loops that are being made through 10 years of research that you wouldn't have the slightest idea that are going to become important. So I'll just toss those out, you know, as a little sidelight for people to keep track of these kind of things and watch how connections are made over the years within recurring themes and the level of importance that they eventually might assume, whereas the initial response might be at the level, you know, of humor and or ridicule or the Internet buzz that was successful in the early years, at least to some degree. On to this consideration of a child. There was a child that offered his or her blood to be looked at under the scope. And this paper is called And Now Our Children, and it was written on January 11th of 2008. We can just see, I know I can see now looking back, just a lot of things were able to be done in November through January of the turn of the year last year.
That's a very productive time.
And these pictures are actually, they're pretty darn clear as I look. This is the best I can do with my scope. I know somebody else might say it's blurry, and all, that's all true. But nevertheless, these are actually pretty remarkable photos. And what you have here is a 9-year-old child that is willing to put have their blood put under the scope. I have to say, you know, it's just a very kind and generous thing, an unselfish thing of this parent as well as the child to do.
Indeed.
Because, you know, this is it's a heavy subject for people
sure.
to deal with. And for somebody to do that, it does take an act of courage, even whether it appears to be anonymous or not. It takes an act of courage to do that, to open yourself up to examination like that. And this was really unknown. I had no idea what to expect. But the end result is that when the blood sample of this 9-year-old was looked at in the same way that it was for all of the other individuals, meaning including those that manifested visible symptoms on the outside as well as those who don't,
you see
the same exact structures within the blood. Okay? And if somebody looks at these photographs, I have three. I will always try to find sort of the best case I can of that blood in terms of cellular uniformity, integrity, you know, no breaching of the cell walls, that type of thing. Always try to find the best that I can in the sample, and I'll put that up, and that's what I did. And I can find that. It's not like the whole sample is necessarily degraded. And so I did that. I start with that. But then there are areas within that blood sample that show these same patterns going on. And, you know, now you have a better photograph that is showing something. You know, it's saying it looks like it's in the cell, folks, not exterior to the cell. It looks like you've got it within the cell. And this is where we can see sort of clearly for the first time that we're dealing with something that if it's inside the blood cell, if that's true, it just causes all kinds of problems with respect to our immune systems, normal testing, whether or not you would ever see such a thing. And yet this is what's showing up, is indication that we're dealing within the blood cell.
Amazing.
Now, and this is what leads to, and I'll mention those when we get back, but this is what leads to the offering, my offering, of a candidate for investigation of chlamydia pneumonia. And there's some very specific characteristics of that organism that are worthy of mention and offer a basis for investigation.
All right. We'll do that in just a couple of minutes with Clifford Carnicom. Okay, and we continue with Clifford, and don't forget his website has all of these articles right there on the homepage. Go right ahead, please, Clifton.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll try to watch my time. I know what you're up against, and I'll try to work with it best I can. But, you know, this the result of this study here that we're talking about, where a child offered their blood for examination, at least for observation, I guess.
Sure.
Is that age does not appear to be a factor here of exclusion, basically. The situation that's being observed is transcending different age groups, anywhere from 9 years old to, you know, 68 years old, something like that. And that now opens up the box even a little bit wider as to how serious this situation might be. And it was at this time, you know, I spent a great deal of time, I'll just say, this was probably, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks, just solid study, you know, in my books, my pathology books and such, to try and find out what is this organism? What could this organism be? And in my case, often I have to work through a process of exclusion. You know, I don't have access to direct identification, so I often usually have to work by indirect means and exclude one thing after another, and it's a very slow process when you're going through all the books that way. But I spent quite a bit of time on this to try to find out what kind of organism, what kind of structure, if it is something conventional, what would match what it is I'm seeing. And at the end of this work, I have come to an assessment. Again, there's nothing conclusive about it in the slightest bit, but yes, I do offer it. I would say, hey, those folks with the proper resources, this is one candidate for you to consider. And I want to go through the list very quickly as to what it is that I came up with that would cause me to at least seriously question the existence of chlamydia pneumonia-like. Here they are. The organism involved must measure on the order of submicron, generally on the order of 0.5 to 0.7 microns. And what it means is every one of these things I'm listing, I'm having a match for, and that's why I offer it as a candidate.
Okay.
That is where chlamydia pneumonia will be. Lowest it'll be is 0.3 up to about a micron. So the size range that I'm getting at is right in there. Size is extremely important. It's certainly one of the first key mechanisms that we can use to at least, certainly you can exclude many, many things from it, if not identify what something is alone. Second, the organism is an intracellular organism and can exist within human red blood cells, erythrocytes. This is pretty profound in terms of that characteristic. This is a, you know, normal bacteria. They're not inside the cells. This is not a common thing. This is a very serious issue when you have a bacterial form, if indeed that's what it is, that occurs within the cell. Much harder to identify, isolate, see to begin with. I mean, the amount of work it took to see these things was very extended, and I have serious questions or doubts as to whether any conventional testing procedure would even approach this problem. By the way, I will mention this. After I came up with this assessment, it was after the fact, but I did a search on has there been any association or identification of chlamydia pneumonia with the Morgellons condition? And I found actually some pretty strong references that were saying that, yes, it looks like this particular condition is being identified amongst many people. Again, I do not point to anything absolute here. I just offer the leads. But that's a rather major and profound characteristic of this structure that is occurring within the cells. And by the way, at this point, I'll go ahead and mention there is a website. I'm just saying chlamydia pneumonia is something worthy of looking at. Take a look at it. And there's a website called CPN Help, as in Charlie Papa November, cpnhelp.org. That website is devoted towards individuals that realize the seriousness and significance of chlamydia pneumonia and how it manifests. And there's a photograph. If people look closely on that, there is a photograph on that front. I think it's on their front page. Did they pull it from there? It's in their site. Yeah, it's on the front page. It's on the front page. And this was a key turning point for me because they show photographs, and I have to say I have a match the best I can. They show these within erythrocytes, within red blood cells. They have a dark field microscope photograph there, microphotograph of chlamydia pneumonia. And all I can say is we have a match in terms of what's happening there. This stuff occurs within erythrocytes or red blood cells. The people can look at the conditions, the illness conditions that are associated with chlamydia pneumonia. Examples would be multiple sclerosis, chronic fatigue, cardiac disease, arthritis, asthma, fibromyalgia, macular degeneration. You know, people can do their own look at that, but that site would be worthy of looking at, I think,
yeah,
for people.
Pretty difficult to, in a quick diagnosis, tell the difference between other kinds of pneumonia and chlamydia pneumonia, though there's a pretty definite overlay in generalities in terms of manifestations. Cough,
exactly,
fever,
yeah, crossing many,
breathing,
many lines. And that's a lot of what that website talks about, is how difficult it is for these people to get support or assistance from the medical community in terms of getting this thing identified. To follow through with that list, the next one, if I can find it. Yeah, here we go. The organism is likely to be associated with respiratory conditions and is circulated by aerosol means. If you look up on chlamydia pneumonia, that is how it's circulated, is in the air, and it is associated with respiratory illnesses. The organism is spherical to oblate, but can exist in more than one form, pleomorphic. We start looking at these ribbon structures and this type of thing, and I have questions about whether or not we have some transformations of form taking place. And the next one would be a Gram stain produces a negative result. That's a certain type of staining something that shows up certain types of bacterial forms. Basically, I have eight conditions here. And they're matching the best I can, at least from my level, with very strong consideration of this as one component, again, one component of what we may be dealing with.
Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Doxycycline, of course, a primary agent to treat chlamydia pneumonia. Some Morgellons patients have reportedly had marginal relief for a certain period of time with heavy doses of doxycycline, but nothing that can be called a complete cure. All right, be right back in a minute. All right, let's get back to our conversation with Clifford Tarnicom, and we are all ears. Clifford, go right ahead, please.
Thanks, Jeff. The next three papers I'm just going to make mention of. I won't go over them.
They're on Clifford's homepage, too. All right.
Because I know we're going to run out of time as usual, but we've done a great job, I think, trying to get through this. And there's three papers, and these are going on through the month of January, and they go through March, and they get us through the end of March. So January through March. And basically the papers are, one of them will be called Morgellons 5th, 6th, and 7th match. The next one will be called Pathogens in the General Population. And the last one is that wine, red wine, and or peroxide, or actually grape juice, organic grape juice. All three of these seem to be helpful. That's the title of the paper. What I'm going to do is just summarize what these papers are about. And these papers are important in the sense that they represent a consolidation of all that we have been talking about and building up to, you know, over the last couple hours. You know, Leeuwenhoek, if I pronounce his name correctly, apparently this guy, you know, he's probably like me in some ways. You know, he's the guy behind the original microscope. And this guy apparently, when he got under the scope, you know, he was discovering things for the first time. But he would see something, and he's the first person ever seeing it in the history of modern mankind,
first
at least.
Man to look into the inner world.
Yeah, and he sees these things, and it's like he does it over and over and over and over, because he has this thing about wanting to convince himself, I guess, that this is what he's actually seeing. So he does these things just hundreds of times because he wants to be absolutely confident of what he's doing. In some ways, I feel like that because, you know, I try not to rush anything here. And this period that I'm talking about now, from January through March, represents a time period where, you know, I'm under the scope over and over and over to see whether or not, no matter where I go with the samples, am I seeing the same things over and over? And the answer is yes. And it takes a great deal of time to get there, but these papers are summarizing what it is that you and I have been talking about. And that is, you know, this work is at the point where there are four or five, depending how we want to go about it, I would say five at this point, five basic physical forms that are being seen over and over and over, independent of whether somebody is manifesting a skin condition or not. these forms are crossing all major body systems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, digestive, mm-hmm. urinary, blood, hair, dental, crossing all major system functions of the body across the board, whether somebody is manifesting a so-called skin condition or not. The name Morgellons is something that I truly have to qualify because it's been basically put into a little box and category and just not appear to encompass the scope of the situation that we're talking about. So that's the result of that work, and that's what I offer as a base or a starting point. And I've made the point before, and I'll make it again, and that is it's not okay with me to say I'm seeing this over and over and over. I'm taking the photographs over and over and over. I'm telling you over and over and over what they are. And we go on and we go on and we go on, and we do not have that stuff immediately. Not a matter of planning a year or two down the road, but immediately under the highest quality equipment that's available to all of mankind. Immediate positive identification of what it is, and if it doesn't fit in a normal scope and we don't have positive identification, then you allow for something new that we need to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
But to not have this done, you know, I won't let it go, just as I will not let the EPA go until this job is done. None of us are off the hook. And that's my call, and it will be continue to be my call until it's done. And I suspect if I keep up the rant long enough, well, we're going to get it done. And it may be done in different means than things are done normally. So what I wanted to go on to next was, and this is a topic I haven't written up. There's a couple things I'd like to probably finish our conversation with. One will be sort of another example of how the research links in to the past many times years ago that we don't understand at the time how significant that it may be or what importance it is. And then hopefully we can also get some couple of unusual photographs in by the end of the night that we
okay.
missed last time.
Right.
But I'd like to go on to a topic, and this is a case where this is just, let's say, circulating in my head. This is something I haven't written up yet. But there's some interesting things going on in terms of connections. And I have to recount some history here, and I'll take a little bit of time with this, probably the majority of what we have left besides that photograph. But it has to do with proteins. And here's what happens. If we go back to the earliest work, when the fiber samples, environmental fibrous airborne samples, are presented to me, and I start putting them under the scope with my little 30 power or 100 power toy microscope and my strapped on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And what do? I start subjecting these fibers to all types of analysis. Straightforward, common sense science. Nothing real special, but something that anybody could do if they wanted to. But a lot of observations, beginning of measurements. I start learning about fibers in general. I become pretty decent at identifying most type of fibers. Go through all the natural and synthetic fibers.
Right.
Get down the
and
sizes.
There are a lot of them.
This stuff. And this stuff was done in 1999. And the photographs, it's sort of funny to see them, you know, because they're circular, you know, as you get the vignetting looking through the microscope there. I'm pretty primitive. But they do show you the original form of what we saw going on. Well, there were some chemical tests that those things were subjected to, and I would basically try different solutions, different reagents, just to see if I could get a reaction. What happens to these things?
Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the board to all these fibers, as well as the EPA fiber. Well, if you look at this, again, it's not really stated with any kind of exclamation, but I was after a reaction. That was my goal. I don't care what the reaction is. I just want to see if I can get a reaction. And if you look at these photographs, you're going to see something that's a little different, and that is that when that fiber sample was subjected to a hair perm solution, there is a reaction, a significant one, and it does seriously degrade, we could say not quite dissolve, but seriously damage the structure of that filament. It turns sort of into a gel-like structure. It's obviously breaking it down, and it's the only solution that I found that had that type of impact upon those fibers. Now, the question starts to come up, what the heck are you doing using hair perm solution, and why?
All right, we'll find out in just a minute. This is amazing research, and I would urge all of you to go to Clifford's site and avail yourself of it. There's a lot to come. You get the idea that the entire Morgellons community is not focused in one area, and it needs to really do something to get its act together. There are a lot of disparate portions and pieces of it that are going off in strange and unusual trajectories, and somehow we've got to bring people back toward a singular focus, or at least one that approaches or approximates that. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we return in our last segment already with Clifford. All right, Clifford. Great.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm going to try to tie this together. I may not make it, but I'm going to try.
Well, this would be a good jump. I want to hear this.
Now, the folks that would like to make fun of the hair perm approach, I'm going to throw out three terms for you to play with. I hope I get the first one pronounced properly. But the first one is ammonium thioglycolate. This is a chemical compound. Dig into these three things and start forming some questions and links. The second one will be disulfide bonds of sulfur. And the third will be keratin, protein form.
Right.
I'm going to throw out those three terms, and you can play with those instead of having fun with the hair perm game. And there are some questions and things that we're going to be looking at over time that look very, very interesting. Now, why was I interested in this hair perm solution? It's because it reacts to proteins. Now, why was I interested in proteins? Most people don't know this because I've never taken the time to go over it properly, but there was a lab test done. Good money was paid for it. Good money was paid for a private lab to analyze these fibers that the EPA refused to identify.
Mm-hmm.
I received that lab report back. That lab report is false. The results of that lab report are false.
Really?
It's another whole story. If we have time, I'll go into it. But basically, the people come back and they start saying, it's actually very interesting. It gets subjective. They actually have two reports within one, and one of them says, you know, this looks like wool or silk, and the other one says it's like. They don't say, you know, when you send something to a lab, you want to know what it is, not what it might be. And in both cases, they come back and they say it's sort of like wool or silk, and the other one, it's sort of like spider's web. Well, that's false, and there's another whole story to that. I actually went to that lab and confronted that CEO directly with my own work, and I had nine reasons to show that person why I knew that these were not spider webs or any kind of traditional fiber of any kind. We may have made mention to that, but basically I had nine things to go through. I made it through number two, and the CEO told me this meeting is over and terminated our conversation.
Uh-huh.
I made it through number one of the list of nine. The results of that lab were incorrect and false. Now, what is interesting, though, is that on that lab report, there is a reference to the existence of proteins, a protein, let's say, component or aspect to the fibers. So in my work, to test things, I wanted to find out, all right, how do I learn if something is protein-based or not, regardless of what it is? And you'll find that particular chemical, that ammonium thioglycolate that's in hair perm solutions, is, let's say, very important for breaking down sulfur bonds that are characteristic of keratin protein forms that are present in our hair. Now, why is this all important? Number one, you have initial chemical tests that show a reaction to the environmental sample, unlike anything else, where it does destroy the internal structure of those fibers. Number two, you have a lab report, which at least gives an indication that there may be a protein component involved, but let's say disguises the true objective of that lab identification, whether with intent or not is probably never known.
Mm-hmm.
What's important now to me is that I revisited the subject again. And these dental fibers that you and I have been speaking of tonight,
yes,
I have subjected those to this same chemical solution.
Hmm.
And it basically obliterates them. And there's not many things that seem to do that, by the way. But this chemical breaks down those fibers in a radical way. Now, what does it mean? What it means is that there is a significant basis, again, for investigation of a component, a significant component of these fibers, no matter in whatever form they're occurring, whether they came from the air, whether they came from the skin, whether they came from inside the teeth, as having a proteinaceous component to them, specifically keratin. Now, if you look at a paper I wrote about 2 months ago, I made a little reference on there, and I said, fungal forms, how do you test if something is a fungal form? And you'll see that I found a DOD paper for biological warfare stuff where they develop a method for the testing of keratin within a fungus. In other words, one of the identifying characteristics of a fungal form is the existence of keratin. And here is a link that I just came up with last night. I didn't exactly know this, but why is keratin? Is it just a part of fungus? No. The answer is that fungal forms commonly feed, they live, they thrive on keratin. Okay? Now, why is this important? Because keratin is in our skin. Keratin is in everything about our scalp, our skin. Something like this one paper saying 80% of the outside layer of our skin is keratin-based. All right? There is now, for the first time on my side, it's been claimed many times, but I have no basis for it up until now, there is a significant lead in terms of the investigation of indeed whether there is a fungal aspect to this fibrous form. There is no match to species that can be made. It's clearly not normal, I'll say that. I can find no match at all where you have any kind of encasing filament of a submicron network. But in terms of the chemical reaction that's taken place and the fact that fungal forms feed on keratin and can be used as a means of identification of fungal forms, and when you start looking at where these forms are manifesting in the skin and the hair, and get this is one I was after. I was saying if this idea is right, and at this point it's just a hypothesis, but there is a serious issue involving teeth here. We haven't had time to talk about it, but there's been a significant degradation of teeth that's taking place with this. And one of the first questions I had to ask, if this hypothesis has any basis to it all, shouldn't it be that teeth also would have keratin in them? And I didn't know the answer to this, but I looked up, and sure enough, they do. The enamel of teeth contains keratin. So basically, you have a basis for saying, why are these things manifesting, and what is it that is actually feeding them? And all I'm doing is I'm suggesting that we may have a basis of sustenance or nourishment of a fungal form, not conventional or classical by any means, doesn't fall into regular books, but would feed off the very environment that we find it in, namely teeth, hair, and skin. Again, and what's unique here, too, is those fibrous forms, filament forms, are not within the blood. That's where the chlamydia-like stuff is showing up the most. Okay, so we are talking about this filament form manifesting in the exterior of the body, more so, as well as teeth. So I offer it as a lead, a very interesting lead of investigation, and I'll have to leave it at that. And I know we're running out of time, and this is completely off the subject, but it should be mentioned because it just needs to be. We need to be made aware of it. And that is, I have a couple photographs that somebody sent me about a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. And the title of that paper is called Aerosol Anomalies. And it is pretty amazing. I've never seen anything like it in my life, that's for sure. But if you call up that paper, and I can't actually find it right at this moment, but you have a very high-quality image of a most unusual ring-like structure in the sky. The photograph is very clear. And there's two of them there. You literally have this ring that shows up in the sky. And what's really unique about this is you have a darn emission trail coming from it. I don't know what to make of this yet. But it raises all kinds of interesting questions about why is there this emission trail? What is going on here? Okay, but this is not anything conventional. Let's just say that. And people can look at those photographs and start asking some questions about why would you have and by the way, these objects were identified, were observed, were recorded in the midst of significant aerosol operations, okay, where we have water planes or appear to be planes. There's a lot of mysteries about all that stuff that can go on. But this clearly does not fit in the normal expectation or genre of what we're talking about when people are starting to talk about emissions of any kind and or any kind of structure in the sky. So, you know, I wanted people to be aware of those photographs and start now asking some other questions about what are we really dealing with here.
Well said. We've got just about 2 minutes left. I see so much to talk about here. Now, we also have the research that Jan Smith has done with these fibers that are observable at 30, 40, 50, 60 power, in which they can withstand literally a butane torch up to around 1,300 degrees. They're tough as nails. Now, these fibers are not the same fibrous masses that are coming out of the mouths after the swishing around of red wine. They're different. Or are you suggesting, Clifford, that they are the same in a matrix form of some kind?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know until we get examination down at the, you know, the microscopic or molecular level.
Sure.
What it is we're dealing with, because
sure.
I have been let's say surprised many times that I don't even begin to know what's going on until I start to see this stuff at this extremely high
right.
magnification. We need good equipment. We need the proper tools to do this.
We do.
And I don't know the answer to that. I will also, yes, it does get complicated. You're right. We could go on for a long time because, you know, there are two other forms that I have seen, and I know some of these reports. And I put that stuff, you know, subject to a flame, that very early work in 99. That's one of the first things I did was subject
yeah,
it to
I
a flame.
Yeah, I think I remember that. We talked about it way back when, yeah.
And I am only one person, and I don't have access to all the resources. I can
right.
simply offer
right.
this vantage point as a basis for people calling
well, these
together
fibers,
to pull together the resources to get this job done right.
Absolutely right. They've got to be compared, absolutely taken apart. There are suggestions that the so-called normal Morgellons fibers upon high magnification show internal fibers in vast numbers. This is fascinating, and for you to have found in your limited research the same markers in 100% of the people is
it is, and that's why it can't be ignored. I mean, you take care of basics first, and then you can
yes.
consider tangents and exotic things when you need to.
It's true, Clifford. I thank you, and I always as usual salute you. Thank you, my friend, for everything, and we'll be here to help you.
Jeff, thank you very much in return and for allowing me the freedom and time to discuss this.
No worries. All right, we'll talk soon. Take care. Clifford Carnicum. Wow. Morgellons. What is it? Well, we're going to find out someday. Be back.